the tabletop. Take away
game mechanics on display.
Three designers share the stage.
Pick a genre and we'll play
the tabletop. Take away.
Welcome back to the Tabletop Takeaway. I'm Ananda Gunaratna.
I'm Charlie McCarron.
And I'm Trevor Muller-Hagel.
And today we are going to return to our series on gateway games with the game Small World. Now, Small World was actually, I think, one of the earliest hobby games that I played. Before that, I'd mostly played mass market games like, you know, Monopoly and Risk and so forth. And so for me, Small World was very much a gateway into the hobby game scene.
Same so, here, yeah.
Yeah, Small World is kind of a, it's kind of like a war game, like Risk. Not a miniatures war game, but, you know, the sort where there's a map and you have a bunch of guys on the map and you're trying to hold territories. Very much like Risk in that sense. But one of the big differences, well, there are a lot of differences, but you are trying to control territories and you score points at the end of each turn for any territories you control on the board. And what makes it kind of unique is that you have a combination of a race and a power. So for example, you might have the Berserk Elves, where Berserk gives you the ability to roll a die before each conquest to add to your strength, and elves don't die when they get taken out. I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but basically everyone has unique power, and you draft these powers from a common market. So every turn, you're going to have a bunch of units, and you're going to use them to conquer regions on the board. And the rules for conquest are very simple, actually. It costs 2 tokens to take over a region, plus 1 token for each enemy or obstacle that's in that region. So, like, if there's a mountain in the region, that's 2 plus 1 is 3 tokens. If there's a mountain and a guy already in the region, it costs you 4 tokens. And any units that were in there before are displaced. Well, one of them is killed and the rest of them are returned to their owners. The other interesting thing about the game is instead of conquering on your turn, you can choose to go into decline, which means that your race is no longer active, but it still sits on the board and earns you points until somebody else takes it out. And the reason you'd want to do this is because then next turn you can pick a new race power combination and bring them onto the board. And I think that's most of the game. The game plays out over a series of rounds. In our game, there were 12 rounds. And whoever has the most points at the end wins. You mainly get points by conquering regions, but you can also... Or sorry, not by conquering regions, by holding regions. But some of the races and powers also give you other ways to get points. Like, for example, my merchant sorcerers just got an extra point for each region. And I think that's most of the important rules.
It's a great game. I, like you, played a lot back in the day and hadn't played for a while, but it strikes me as more elegant than I remember, even.
Yeah, me too.
The core fun, I think, comes for me from the combos, like choosing
Absolutely.
Which power, because it's so impactful. We've talked about that before, where it's like you want your decisions to be impactful, and you don't need that many decisions, but like it's the racers and magical athlete, you know, like what's yeah. the fun thing you can play with? And then the other piece that I think is super cool is how decline works and choosing when to go in decline. It's like these once per game. Well, it's not once per game, but it's like
once per faction,
Yeah.
You're generally going to do it only a couple of times during a game because it takes your whole turn.
Yeah.
You still get points, which is great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, comparing it a little bit to Magical Athlete. It does have the same sense that you have a couple choices that are really, really impactful, but you don't have to do those all the time. And then you care a lot about the outcomes of those choices.
Yeah.
Now, this is a game that has a fair amount of politics in it, you know, sort of convincing people to go after others or not go after you. And it's it is quite easy to go after a specific player, although they could be on the other side of the map from you to avoid you.
Yeah. I liked how I had kind of forgotten how the battles worked, and they're not even really battles most of the time. It's just, yeah, I can conquer you.
Yeah, it doesn't have like a die system like Risk does. You know, you have a threshold that you're trying to meet with your units, and that's just based on what's currently in that territory.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is very elegant.
Yes.
And defending is essentially like warding people. Like, it's, yeah, you're basically deciding how much you want to like repel someone else from wanting to attack you. So, because they can do it if they have enough guys. It's just how much do they want to reinforce, or yeah, how much they want to spend.
Yeah. And it's very consistent in the rules for defense. So, like, each thing that's in a region is going to add one to the defense. It's not like, oh, my fortification adds two and your troll lair adds three. It's like, okay, each piece of cardboard, that's plus one. All you need to do to figure out the defense of a region is count the amount of cardboard. And that's really nice, especially for a gateway game, because, you know, it makes it very easy to pick up. You don't need to understand exactly how someone's power works, because for your purposes, the main thing that matters is how much cardboard is in the region.
And in reality, if the manufacturing is consistent enough, you could have it just stand the stack next to the other stack and see if it's taller.
Yeah.
And then you can take it.
Yeah. I guess the other consistent thing is there's these little tokens that are circular and kind of pointy. Like the halfling hobbit hole thing is like that.
Yeah.
And there's also a dragon that's like that. That we didn't see in our game. And those are just consistently, this territory is invulnerable. You can't go here. So that's another place where the rules are very consistent for the tokens, which I think
That's really nice.
Helps a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was a big fan of the randomized smash up, and then you choose which one you like. And then, you know, the new ones are placed at the end of the market, and each one costs successfully one more coin to get, and coins are victory points. So it's like, okay, well, do I really want that new one that just came out? It's a really powerful ability. Is it worth giving up that many victory points to choose that group?
Yes.
I thought that was a great little dynamic.
Yeah, the drafting system does make you think about what you want. I guess the fact that victory points are currency for buying the new races, I guess I'm not sure about. There's this is maybe something we can talk about. Using victory points as currency, like
in general,
I'm remembering, for example, the Great Zimbabwe is an example of a game where you have two currencies, right? There's the VRs, so like some things will increase your victory requirement, which is essentially like spending points. But then there's also the cattle, which you can use to buy other things. And so, you know, you really feel encouraged to spend the cattle, but you don't want to spend the victory points.
Mm-hmm.
And in this game, everything costs victory points. So buying the more expensive races does feel quite punishing, I think.
Yeah, and honestly, to put it in another light too, I had a game that did this where your health determines the abilities you can do, and then you spend health to use your abilities, and a lot of people said that does not feel good. You know, if I'm making it so I'm going to lose the game by doing my abilities. It's like the old, like, side-scrollers, too, in, like, the arcades, where you'd use your special ability, you know, with the joysticks and all the buttons, and that would use part of your health, and you only had a certain number of lives, and then you'd have to put in more tokens. Obviously, that was to get people to spend more money on the arcade machines. But ultimately, it kind of creates this weird push and pull, like, well, maybe I just want to hold on to that. And you have that kind of potion mentality from video games where it's like, well, I don't want to use my potions because what if I need it later?
So yeah, I guess when...
go ahead. Yeah.
Well, just when should you use victory points as a currency? Like, when does that make sense?
I have an idea. I think when you know the end of the game is going to be around 100 points, I think it's okay.
When you understand
when you understand level, that you're going to get a lot more points throughout the game, just the scale of it is not so bad. Like in most cases, the most you're going to give up is 5 victory points.
Yeah,
but you usually make around 10 every turn. So I kind of like that it's the 1-to-1. Yeah, because it's really obvious, and actually I think more approachable for players to understand. It's not like obscured behind some calculation of like, well, if this is my money, how much is that going to earn me during the game? It's like, no. Do you think you can get more points than you're spending on it? And in the opposite way, it's helping in the draft where it's like, well, I don't really like these powers, but it's going to get me like 3 points off the bat because no one took it for a while.
Right.
And I think...
Okay, so...
Yeah. And just real quick, I think another game that uses it that I do like is Five Tribes. Similar thing, you're betting on your... you're betting on if you want to be first player or not. And it's kind of fun to think about, like, is it worth giving up these points because I see a really good move out there? And that's kind of got the same feel of, like, ooh, I found a really good combo, and I feel clever about... I know that someone else will want this, so I'm just going to do it.
I think you're really onto something with the, as a percent of total VP throughout the game, if you're talking 1-5% from the design standpoint, then that actually isn't too bad. And for gateway games, especially, like you're saying, having not multiple resources, just having that one resource that you're using, and that is also victory points.
Yeah, that's... That is a really good point. Not having to make the calculation in your head about how much the secondary resource is worth.
Well, it's 2 points per wood, 3 points per coin, 1 point per card.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's a good point. It does also make me think a little bit about. Okay, so you know, in this case, you're sacrificing the victory points. But we have seen examples in the past in some games, you can just convert them to other things.
Right.
Like
right.
In Indonesia, you know, when you were bidding with money, and money is points, but the money is still worth points. It's just not usable anymore.
As money, yeah.
That it is a good way to reduce the number of different resource systems that you have in a game using victory points. How about the combat die? So,
the reinforcement
combat
die.
Is mostly right. The reinforcement die. So combat is mostly deterministic in this game. However, your last conquest of a turn, you get to roll a reinforcement die, which usually comes up blank. But in theory, you might roll enough to take over that last territory. What I think about. So one thing I like a little bit about this is the numbers in this game are pretty small. Like combat is very granular, right? Like because you need 2 troops. To conquer a region plus however many obstacles there are. So the difference between having 2, you know, 1 troop left over in your supply and 2 troops is huge, right? Like a lot of the time, you're going to end up without the exact right number of troops for all the conquests you want to make on your turn. I think the reinforcement die is a very nice way. It's a nice compromise to keep those numbers low while, you know, avoiding players being disappointed by falling short all the time. Because, you know, it's always possible you might be able to use that leftover unit.
I did forget about that die a lot when I was kind of planning my turn. I was always trying to do like a zero sum where it's like, okay, I have 5 points. I need to do a 3 and a 2 cost location. Where can I go with that? And it did often leave me a little bit like, oh, I wish I had one more or two more. Then again, also every time I rolled the reinforcement die, I got a 0. And so that was a little disincentivizing. But I do appreciate that it gives you that chance at the very least.
Yeah. I would be curious with a lot of things in this game to ask the designer, like, where did so Philippe Cayart, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but where did he start with this game? And like, the reinforcement die feels like maybe it was at the end when people gave him feedback about like, the battles are too static. And
I was gonna say the beginning,
really,
and then he weaned it down to the end because it's very much a risk thing.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, yeah, maybe if he was more in the mindset of risk, maybe people were rolling all the time, and he
realized,
"Wait, that's
just taking so much time, so much math,
so much time." Yeah.
I think this game evolved from, I think it's called Vinci, which has, I might be wrong about this. I think it was like a Roman or at least an ancient civilization theme in Vinci, but now it's more of a fantastical theme. I think that's what it came from. I might be forgetting that, but in terms of specifically where it came from, but yeah, I don't know the thought process behind it, of course.
Yeah,
we can only pontificate.
We can. And my guess here is that it also always had that like creature plus ability.
Yeah, I think Vinci has the same mechanic.
Yeah. Two randomized things.
Yeah, you combine two things to make one. I haven't played Vinci, so I don't know much about it.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to start to say a takeaway. Because that is my takeaway, is the comboed things that you're drafting is.
I was also going to be my takeaway, but that's good. Go ahead and keep going.
It's so good. I mean, that's
a great one.
This game.
Yeah.
Because I think sometimes in games, combos are harder to find. And you do feel clever when you find them, but it might take a lot of the game to find a cool combo. And this game's just like, no, here's the combos. Figure out which one is going to be the most fun to play.
Diplomatic trolls. Heck yeah.
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 And yeah, what did I have? My favorite
Hill
combo.
Skeletons.
Hill Skeletons was okay. I liked my first one, though. It was, I forget if they were called merfolk or something.
No, like tritons.
Tritons.
Yeah.
And they also could go to any caverns. So away, I'm breaking the rules of the game. I'm going
jumping around the map.
Anywhere on the map. And it cost me less troops. I just,
yeah,
that was a very fun beginning.
Yeah,
it was a very
absolutely
good first pick. Yeah, there is, and it does. It creates a lot of You know, it's variable player powers, right?
Right.
And it, I think it does variable player powers quite well for a gateway game. I think one of the things it does that I like is that on the board, you know, there's lots of different types of terrain, and there's some of the terrain have little features of interest, like magic sites.
Mines.
Or caves. And none of it does anything unless you have a power that interacts with it, which makes it quite easy to learn, right? I don't need to worry about what makes a field different than a forest or what a magic site does, because it's only relevant if I have a power that interacts with it.
But it still kind of gives you this sense of like, oh, this world is, there's a lot going on here that I could tap into.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I guess it also, it's sort of, it foreshadows to you that, okay, you know, there's some cool stuff going on, and right. I don't know what any of this is yet, and I don't need to know what it is, but it's going to come up. It may come up later. And then you see the race come out that interacts with magic sites, and you're like, okay, well, that's where that was going.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like one of my things that I think I've always thought would be cool to have more of this in video games and board games, too, like translated over. But like playing through a level or something, and there's maybe things that aren't meaningful to you at all the first time around, but then you come back maybe and things now that I didn't think it mattered do matter.
That's very much the Metroidvania style platformers, because like, you know, you now have this new item, you now see that green moss on that ledge, you know, you can like grapple to it or whatever it is and like swing, like you just start to see things in different lights. And I think that's a really good point. Like, it's kind of that emergent complexity, but not even complexity, just like increases interest and options and like, oh, what else can this game do?
Callbacks.
Yeah. Well, Ananda, what was that game you were inspired by, the video game where you could, there's certain things you could do in the world and you didn't even know you had the ability to do them until
Are you talking about Tokitori 2?
Maybe.
The game where you have two abilities and everything else is just learning how they interact with the environment?
Yes.
Yeah,
that's... You should describe that a little bit.
So in Tokitori 2, it's a video game. You're this flightless bird, and you have two abilities, tweet and stomp. And you can also walk. You can't fly, but you can... And you can't jump, even... Wait, I don't think you can jump, but you can walk and you can like climb ladders and stuff. And you never get any more abilities, but as you go through the world, you learn how certain things work. It's been a while since I played it, but like, for example, there are these larger birds that will fly around and I think they'll come and pick you up under certain conditions and not under others. I'm forgetting specifics, but like it's a Metroidvania, but it's I've heard the genre referred to as Metroidbrainia, which of course, you know, Metroidvania plus brain, because the thing that changes is not your
what
character,
you right?
Yeah, you don't like gain new power ups. You learn how the system works, and the cool thing is this means that. You know, if you're dropped into one of these games from the beginning, like you reset your save file or whatever, you can go straight to the end because the you know, the power is in you. It's not in the game. It's not in your character. It's you. You are the progression. Outer Wilds, that space gate time loop game. That's another great example of this. I think it's Outer Wilds. Metroidbrainia, really fun genre. It feels great when, you know. Yeah,
yeah. I wonder if there's a way to bring that into board games. And as you were saying that, it's like, okay, well, there are some games where it's like, well, most games, you're going to get better at it. You are leveling up in your brain. So you can maybe find pathways through that you didn't think about before. But like, is there a way to formalize that somehow in a... game?
So, well, okay, so like in any game, you improve by refining your heuristics about the game and just learning how to play better. I think the distinction with Metroidvania games is your progress is actually gated. Like, you know, it's not a matter of you getting, I mean, you are getting more skilled, but you aren't able to get past certain obstacles until you learn more about how the game works. Whereas in board games, generally it's more of an efficiency question, right? There's not like things you can't get past. It's just, okay, I'm this efficient at the game and now I've learned a better strategy, so I'm even better and I'm going to get more points. So it is kind of it's similar in that you're learning in both cases, but it is different. And it's harder to do that in a board game because players have to know all the rules.
Well, that was a fun tangent.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I'd better give a takeaway probably. So I think my takeaway for this game is probably that combat should be fast, especially when it's happening a lot. You know, when I was a kid, I played quite a bit of Risk before I encountered Small World. And combat is so tedious in Risk. It's just endless rolling of dice over pretty insignificant stakes, too. In a game with so many territories, conquering a territory should not take very long.
Yeah.
And I think my takeaway is that, you know, if you have a game with a lot of combat, where it's just very routine, make it as fast as possible. I like Root is another good example of a game that makes combat really fast, right? You attack, you roll the dice, and then it's done. You know, none of this back and forth. Dune, the original Dune board game, combat is quite involved, maybe a little bit too involved, although combat's also very impactful when it happens, so maybe... But it still feels pretty involved in that game. I think generally in this sort of strategy war game with, you know, lots of territories, go and take the territories, make combat fast. That's my takeaway. And Small World has the fastest combat system I have seen.
Yeah.
It's great.
Absolutely. Also, before I know someone, I thought about this at the very beginning. There's 10 rounds in Small World, at least for what we played.
Was it 10? I was remembering 12.
Which is why the 10 points per round is 100 points or so. Like, yeah, I just realized that as we were talking. I'm like, oh, yeah, shoot. But before I go too crazy, I also have a takeaway that I want to talk about, which is something I don't know if we actually mentioned, the abandoning regions. I actually think it's really nice for a gateway game because, like, you don't know what you're doing, especially when you start out playing. If you have the ability, like, oh, that was a bad move I did before, I want to move out of that region. And as Ananda did when we were playing, you can actually re-enter if you abandon all of your regions. And you can go back to the outside board and just kind of refigure yourself again.
Yeah, that turned out to be a terrible decision.
But it also, like, from a design standpoint and for a beginner standpoint, I think it's a really great option to have. Because if you just get yourself in a really bad situation, you always have a way out.
Yeah.
And then you can come back into the game instantly, which I think is great. It does cost something. It's not free. You know, you have to then reconquer territories. You've lost that income. But, you know, it's a learning experience. And so you're not totally punished for that maneuver.
Yeah. And it also adds to the sense of, like, well, I'm not totally safe. Someone could come along and kill my hill skeletons
from behind
that I left. Yep.
Yeah, so that my takeaway being always kind of allow a back out strategy for gateway games because, like, I think that's really important to have.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, that was a fun conversation on Small World and Metroidvanias. tune in next time for our wrap up episode on gateway games.
Hey, thanks for listening to The Tabletop Takeaway. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. So please tell your friends and visit our website at thetabletoptakeaway.com where you can suggest games and mechanics for us to cover next on the show.